This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with attorney Michael Krinsky about recent developments in Cuba.
Michael's the lawyer for Cuba, has been for 45 years, and has waited for this moment that entire time.
We'll talk with civil rights attorney Jonathan Moore about the need for changes in New York City Police Department policies and his representation of Eric Garner.
What's next in the Garner case? And what's next in New York and around the country to try and rein in police abuse?
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Musty Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
We're joined today by New York City attorney Michael Krinsky, a partner in the famous law firm of Rabinowitz, Boudin, Standard, Krinsky, and Lieberman. This is the firm that represents and has represented, almost from the beginning, the government of Cuba. We will speak with Michael Krinsky about the dramatic reversal of American policy in the recognition by the United States of the Cuban government and the eventual establishment of joint embassies. We'll also speak about the returning to Cuba of the three remaining anti-terrorist Cuban fighters who've been in American prisons for 16 years, three men of the so-called Cuban Five. And we will also speak about the possible changing in commercial relationships and travel between the United States and Cuba. Michael Krinsky, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Good to be here.
It's very nice to have you here. You've been representing the Cuban government for many, many years, and you happened to be down there 2 weeks ago when the news came out. What was it like?
It was an extraordinary moment. Word got around that President Raul Castro was going to talk to the Cuban people on television at noon. So everyone ran to find a television, including me, to see what
you had no
he was
idea.
Say. Well, I had some idea.
He is the attorney for Cuba, Michael. I mean, it's not like you and I were sitting here.
Yeah. But I think generally speaking, most people were surprised at the extent to which Obama went in saying he was going to seek normalization of relations. I think many people, anyway, had expected President Obama to take some minor measures, perhaps as to test the waters, perhaps to get things moving. But I think most people were really quite surprised at the tone of his speech and what he said. The reaction was palpable. I mean, I happened to be at a conference of U.S. and Cuban scholars, which were talking about the U.S.-Cuban relations, and that's where I saw President Castro give his speech. First thing he said, well, of course, was the Cuban heroes, the three of the remaining Cuban Five, were home. And place broke into pandemonium, and people jumped up and literally hugging each other. People were crying. And then they quieted down and they listened to the next thing. And then when he said, President Obama and I have agreed to reestablish normal diplomatic relations, there was silence, stunned silence. And then people, you know, half a second later, absorbed what they had just heard, and again there was a tremendous commotion. People felt a sense of, I think, of triumph. The person on the street, people I spoke to, just people on the street who I spoke to, people in the government, I think felt a genuine sense of triumph that after 55 years of holding on despite Bay of Pigs, despite blockade, economic blockade, despite the special period when the Soviet Union collapsed, they had held on. And in the end, as someone put it, the United States came to us. And so there was a tremendous sense of vindication and of triumph. You could see it on the street. You could see it in the restaurants. You could see it in the offices. People were happy. They were smiling. They were literally smiling for days afterwards. And they would go and they would congratulate each other. Like, we did it. We did it. So it was quite a moment.
Now, Michael, when you talked about, this is Michael Ratner speaking, when you talked about Raoul's speech, and I read it right afterwards, and I was amazed by it because of the way he started with the Cuban Five, then went to diplomatic relations, and then went to the embargo, was the third point. On the embargo, he essentially somewhat, I wouldn't say differed from Obama. He said there still remains a lot to be done, and Obama can do a lot more. So talk a little bit about the embargo, what it's meant for Cuba, and what can be done now.
Well, the embargo has been in effect for essentially 54 years. It is as comprehensive an economic embargo as this country has ever imposed, and perhaps any country has ever imposed against any country. And it's not simply the U.S. saying, we, the United States, won't trade with Cuba. A major part of it is its extraterritorial reach, its effort to make trade between Cuba and third countries difficult and impossible where they can go that far, and has a tremendous impact on the Cuban economy, and has for 50 years. They can't get U.S. Parts for their equipment, for their machinery. They cannot use U.S. dollars in international transactions. Even if the transactions don't involve the United States, they can't use U.S. dollars, which is the currency of international trade. Shipping to Cuba is made extremely difficult because of U.S. law that says if you trade with Cuba, if a ship goes to Cuba, it can't come to the United States for 6 months. And that distorts trading patterns, shipping patterns. Everyone in Cuba lives on a daily basis with what they, I think, rightfully call a blockade, not just an embargo, which implies just bilateral trade. A blockade implies an effort to disrupt trade between the United States, Cuba, and a third country. Everyone lives with it. People would, this week, the prior week when I was down there, would say, come up to me and they say, I have lived my entire life under the blockade. And now perhaps, and I thought maybe my children or grandchildren would see the end of it, but now perhaps I will see the end of it. But Raoul's point is, I think, a very important one, which is it's far from over. The steps that Obama announced are very small, very discreet steps in very specific areas. I mean, they're important. They're a good beginning, but they are very limited. For example, if you want an example, there is nothing there about Cuban products being sold in the United States.
It's all one way, really.
It's all one way. And yeah, Cubans have, you know, people are surprised to find this, Cubans have developed a lot of medical products, innovative medical products that some doctors are very excited about. They can't come into the United States. And, of course, you know, all the famous Cuban products of rum and cigars and so forth. So that's all, what he said was all one way at the moment. So he hasn't even begun that part of the dismantling of the blockade. Even on travel, which, you know, he talked about it opening up travel more, there was nothing in the announcements about regular air service, regular airplane service between the two countries. If there's going to really be an opening of travel between the United States and Cuba, there has to be regular air service. People just can't get there from here unless there's regular air service, not in the kind of volume that Obama is talking about.
And you still need to fit into a certain category for travel, right?
And you need to fit within 12 specific categories. Travel, ironically, is the one significant area where Congress has limited the president's executive authority.
So in other words, in other areas, the president can do pretty much what he wants under the embargo. He can open it up quite a bit.
Yeah. The president has retained, despite all the legislation passed by Congress, has retained the licensing authority to license categories of transactions or specific transactions. He can't deregulate relations with Cuba. He can't say you don't need a license. But he can grant the licenses and in very, very broad categories. You know, President Carter granted, before legislation limiting travel, President Carter opened up travel completely by a license.
I remember. I was on a flight from New York, AeroAir. It was a CIA proprietary, I think. And we flew directly from Orange County down to Havana. I couldn't believe it. After spending years of my life, says Michael Ratner, going through Mexico City or Jamaica or Canada, I drove upstate. I got on a plane.
Exactly.
And there I was.
Exactly.
But it's only 6 weeks, though, it lasted or something, 6 months. Very short time.
Yeah. It lasted. Yeah. And then there were alternative relations, and they started cutting back on it. Even on travel, Obama is limited to 12 categories. One of those categories in particular is a broad category, people-to-people contact. But even there, we don't know how broad he's going to open it up. Can individuals go themselves, or do they still have to go through under the auspices of some organization in the United States? Do they have to have a preset programmed activity, or can they go and wander around meeting people? These are questions that are not have not been answered in anything I've seen.
But in the end, really, what you're saying is, but in the travel area, which might be a little narrower, the president has the authority to license almost everything, every economic transaction with Cuba at this point.
Right, right. Export, import, financial transactions, loans, credits, investment, all of these things are within the president's licensing authority. And how far he will go in 2 years, you know, remains to be seen.
Let me ask a background question on that is, you know, all the time we read, well, Cuba, you know, in 1959, 1960, 1961, started nationalizing U.S. property, et cetera, and that's why the embargo was imposed. You give us a little, I think there's a more nuanced history to this.
Yeah, actually, it's really quite different, the real history. And you know, historians have written about it. But if you get into the State Department documents, and they've published a fair amount over the years because enough time had passed, you know, the picture is really quite different. The nationalizations was, you know, part of the story, but it was a minor part of the story. The United States did not want a left-wing socialist revolution to succeed in the Americas. You know, I was looking at the documents published by the State Department about the severance of diplomatic relations. They were planning it for months before they actually severed diplomatic relations in January 1961. And the nationalization of U.S. property is barely mentioned in all these documents. It's all about the socialist character of the Cuban Revolution. According to them, its efforts, and about Cuban foreign policy, its efforts to promote and support leftist movements in other countries in Latin America, and its increasing alliance with the Soviet Union. That was the theme both publicly and internally in the U.S. government until about 1991, 1992. And then there was a shift. And then for the first time, the United States publicly started talking about the goal of U.S. policy, including the blockade, was to change the internal character of the Cuban system, the Cuban government. Civil liberties, multi-party, free elections, free speech. Those became, for the first time, the articulated goals of U.S. policy. Before then, it was entirely different things. And of those different things, the nationalizations was a minor part. After all, you know, there have been nationalizations. Many countries have nationalized property. And after a while, after many years usually, it's resolved in one fashion or another. It was never the driving force.
Right. In fact, a lot of the embargo really was increased after the Bay of Pigs invasion, right? In the 61
invasion.
Yeah,
it was really not really in full force until they did not invoke the Trading with the Enemy Act, which is the main source of the sweeping character of the embargo until 1963.
Let me step back and ask you about your firm's involvement and your involvement with Cuba, which goes back many, many years. You, of course, are a partner with the famous law firm Rabinowitz, Boudin, Standard, Krinsky, Lieberman, and now I understand you have a new partner in the firm. How did your firm get involved representing the government of Cuba, and then how did you get involved?
Well, the firm's history with Cuba, I'm told, since I was not there at the beginning, came out of the fact that during the 50s, during the McCarthy period, the firm had represented many intellectuals, writers, scholars, activists who had come under attack by McCarthy himself, UAC, loyalty oaths, and so forth. Cuban Revolution takes place, and some of these people go down to Cuba. Some of these U.S. people that the firm had represented goes down to Cuba and write about it, and in a few cases actually became advisors to the to the new government. And at a certain point, the Cuban government, I'm told, said, you know, we're gonna need some U.S. lawyers. There's probably going to be some trouble. And so these folks who knew the firm said, well, you know, there's Victor Rabinowitz, Leonard Boudin in New York. They're really good lawyers. You should speak to them. So that's how that began. And the firm was retained in September 1960. I came to the firm in 1970, not because of that work, but because of all the work, anti-war work he was doing. But then I got there, and I had never even taken a course in international law in law school. I said, why would one want to know something like that? I mean, how irrelevant can you get? But I came, and then I found that the international work of the firm's representation of Cuba, and for a time Allende's Chile, found it very, very compelling. You know, I was told the embargo was going to be over soon, but, you know, I should learn something about it, and that was, you know, A couple of years ago.
All the Cubans who left Cuba thought they were coming back in a few months to reclaim whatever they left. But anyway,
didn't happen. we do represent a fair number of U.S. organizations, individuals, businesses that have to contend with the embargo. And, you know, I'm just speaking here as a lawyer who knows something about this area. Not on behalf of any of our clients. So that's how I got involved. The telephone conversation between the two presidents was hopefully a real turning point.
Yeah, let's hope so. But let me ask about a couple of things that have come up in the wake of it. One is Guantanamo, the U.S. military base in Cuba, not just the current iteration of it, which is where it's keeping prisoners, but the question of whether it'll ever be returned to Cuba. Can you tell us why it's there altogether, and then is that coming up at all? Is that going to be an issue when they go down the line?
Well, you know, it wasn't mentioned in any of these that I saw in any of these public statements by either government. It's been there since basically the Spanish-American War. The United States was supposed to be just a naval station for coaling. You know, ships operated on coal then. That's why it was established, and there was a 99-year lease in between a captive Cuban government and the United States. And then it was changed to in perpetuity. I think everyone assumes that at some point this part of Cuba's sovereign land will be returned to sovereign control by the United States. But that is something that I would not expect that to be early on the agenda of discussions.
And another issue that's come up all along, and I don't know if you have any knowledge about it, of course, is with
people who've taken asylum in Cuba.
I don't know about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I wouldn't think you would know what, no, what, no. what that is. I know there's a number of people who have, and people want to know, are they coming back? What's happening? And,
I don't know.
I mean, Cubans have made a statement that they're not.
Josefina Vidal, who's the head of the U.S. desk at the Cuban Foreign Ministry, I saw made his statement yesterday that Cuba maintains its right to grant political asylum, like every other country has a right to grant political asylum. But beyond that, I'm not aware of anything.
So how are you feeling about your work right now, Michael? Feeling you've been at it, I mean, since you and I became lawyers around the same year, 1970, and you know, I've followed you obviously forever and worked with you on a number of cases, but so it's only been 44 years of work.
I think like a lot of people in Cuba, I mean, I'm trying to find the right balance between a great deal of enthusiasm and excitement and not necessarily skepticism, but caution. There's a long way to go before things have really changed. Obama's statement that we are, the United States is going to seek normalization, and his statement that we are going to establish normal diplomatic relations, I think is, you know, a very significant change. The U.S. policy for the preceding 50-odd years has been to try to go around the Cuban government to the Cuban people. That's the most benign way of putting it. I mean, there was blockade, invasion, sabotage. And then, you know, as all of that failed, the administrations, every prior administration, I must say, with more or less nuance, have pursued a policy of trying to go around the Cuban government to what they thought was the Cuban people, who they kind of always have misread what the Cuban people stand. But not to make it simple, but they've always misread it. Here, it was not saying that. It was saying, we're going to deal with the Cuban government. We recognize this government not only in a strict legal sense, but we recognize it in terms of a diplomatic sense of being a sovereign, an equal sovereign, a government that we're going to deal with and that we're going to negotiate with. For people who don't quite know the history, that is a remarkable change. It's a remarkable change when the photograph that the White House chooses to put on its website to announce this is a photograph of President Obama on the telephone speaking with President Castro.
Amazing.
And that is a very, very powerful statement of a shift in attitude. The State Department documents making the final recommendation to sever diplomatic relations said, why do we want to sever diplomatic relations? Is because one of the first reasons they list is that we want to signal to the Cuban people that we do not consider this government legitimate or permanent.
Wow.
And so so now the establishing diplomatic relations, you know, implies the exact opposite. It's legitimate, it's permanent, and there will be negotiations, government-to-government negotiations. So it's a big change.
Rabinowitz and Boudin brought a fair number of cases around Cuba and the embargo, and one of them you argued, I think, a banking case in the Supreme Court. One was called Wald v. Reagan, which was an embargo challenge, and the other is Sabatino. Let's start with the earliest, which is Sabatino, and just because it's relevant to property, taking of property. And that was the case that essentially said the United States isn't going to interfere in it. But why don't you just tell us what that is.
Yeah, the Sabatino case.
The Supreme Court case,
yes,
Sabatino.
Yes, the United States Supreme Court in 1964 decided a case called Banco Nacional de Cuba versus Sabatino. And at that point, Cuba had nationalized essentially all major U.S.-owned property in Cuba, the U.S. corporations. I mean, there were a great number of companies, U.S. companies whose property have been nationalized. But in truth, most of the value was concentrated, very concentrated. The top 30 companies account for something like 80% of all nationalized property. The top 10 account for almost 50%. And so these companies, many of these companies brought lawsuits in the United States against Cuba to get judgments to seize whatever assets were still around. And they had succeeded, and the lower courts had said, had given judgments and said the Cuban nationalizations were in violation of international law. Supreme Court said something different. It said the courts of the United States should not pass judgment on the legality of the acts of a foreign sovereign, in this case Cuba, done within its own territory. The property was in Cuba. Cuba is a sovereign state. We will not determine, we the courts will not determine the legality of those nationalizations. And underlying that, it said, look, the United States goes around and says nationalizations must be accompanied by full compensation. But the Supreme Court said, and this is one of the things that really got me interested in the international law work at the firm when I read this decision. It said, you know, that's what the United States goes around and says. But there are a lot of countries in the world that say something else. And there is actually, in truth, a great division of opinion, international opinion, between countries on this question. And the Supreme Court put it somewhat euphemistically. The division really is between the capital exporting and the capital importing countries. Really, we would say, you know, between the West and the United States and the Third World. That's the division.
Capital exporting countries. They like to
they like full compensation,
yeah, exactly.
which most people pointed out. Full compensation means no nationalization, because these countries aren't rich enough to pay full compensation. That's why they nationalized. Later on, I mean, interestingly, later on, because of some procedural peculiarities, there was a case which actually decided whether international law requires the payment of full compensation. The Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit here in New York, in a case involving Banco Nacional and Chase Manhattan Bank, said no. It does. If it ever did, we're not sure international law ever required full compensation, but it surely doesn't now anymore since the emergence of all these independent countries that used to be colonies.
Big victories for the
world. Big victories, and something which may be relevant in whatever discussions happen later on between the United States and Cuba on this.
By that you mean all of compensation for what's happened over the last 50 years.
I was glad to see the State Department and it's made reference to this. You know, the United States has claims for the nationalization of the property of its companies in Cuba in the early days. Cuba has a claim, has articulated that has much greater claims against the United States for this blockade and for acts of economic sabotage, in which people have died actually over the years. So there are claims on both sides that have been articulated publicly in the past. Reagan versus Wald was, and you participated in it, Michael, the law firm represented U.S. people who wanted to travel to Cuba. It was our third challenge to the travel ban that went to the United States Supreme Court. It happened after Reagan had come into office. And the Supreme Court said, well, we're not going to second-guess the executive. Yes, you have a constitutional right to travel, but the executive says there are foreign policy considerations, national security considerations that outweigh your constitutional right to travel. And we're terribly sorry, but that right won't prevail. And what were the reasons the United States articulated? There were three. One is Cuba supports armed insurrections in Latin America. Second was Cuba has troops in Africa in positions contrary to U.S. interests. And third, Cuba has this strategic alliance with the Soviet Union, which is in a hostile relationship with the United States. And the Supreme Court said, we're not saying that those are real or weighty enough. We're just saying we, a court, cannot weigh them, cannot evaluate them against your constitutional right to travel. Terribly sorry. The decision was 5-4.
Right, actually. I remember. It was really close.
Really close. Okay. But after that, what happened, of course, is everyone acknowledges Cuba stopped sending arms or supporting armed insurrections in the hemisphere. It no longer had troops in Africa. There was no longer a Soviet Union. And so everyone said, well, now we get our rights back, right? And the answer was no, we still don't give you your rights back. And we still don't have the constitutional right to travel. Right. Through executive action, 12 categories of travel are authorized: professional research for professionals, structured educational programs, and so forth. And sometimes those are open, broader, and sometimes narrowed. We'll see what in reality President Obama does to open those channels now. But the full constitutional right of travel that every American enjoys to every other, literally every other country in the world, still does not apply to Cuba. I think the next 2 years during President Obama's remaining term we're going to see whether what has begun really will take hold and reach to the point where it's irreversible. It was a dramatic week. It was a turning point, we hope, but it still remains to be seen where it will end up.
And I know that one of the people, on a closing note, Michael, one of the people who was actually of counsel to your firm, Lenny Weinglass, yeah. Who was, of course, died a couple of years ago, and a friend of all of ours, but he was the primary lawyer for the Cuban Five.
Absolutely.
And it's too bad he couldn't be here. And, of course, another member of your firm, Deborah Evanson,
yeah.
Lived in Cuba, did a lot of the work for your firm, and, of course, she died as well 2 years yeah. ago. It just tells you, of course, in some way, how long this embargo has been imposed on the Cuban people.
Yeah, we're talking about three generations of lawyers working on this.
That's three generations too many.
And three generations of Cubans struggling with it.
You know? Yeah, well, thank you, Michael, especially for sticking with it for 45 years, what can I say?
Okay, good to see everyone.
Really. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. In the wake of the killing of two NYPD officers, a rift has widened between police unions and the mayor of New York City. The New York City Patrolmen's Benevolent Association has suggested that the recent demonstrations against police misconduct and police violence have played a role in the execution-style murders. To discuss the rhetoric from the police union and the tabloid media, we're joined by Jonathan Moore, a longtime civil rights attorney representing Eric Garner's family in their lawsuit against New York City, the NYPD, and 8 police officers. Jonathan, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
We're in an unusual moment in history where we have many factors coming together, such as police unions, a voracious tabloid media frenzy, and politicians really playing up on the murder of two officers in Brooklyn in a way that we think cramps down on free speech and a mass movement. Can you talk about that from your perspective?
Well, it is a critical moment here in New York City, and I think around the country on the issue of dealing with very aggressive, over-aggressive policing and the militarization of police. I think they sort of go hand in hand. We've been fighting this battle in New York for at least 15 years, going back to the killing of Amadou Diallo. And noticed then and have litigated the stop and frisk cases for many, many years up until the end of last year, end of this year, actually, trying to deal with this over-aggressive policing in certain communities. And it's a problem, and it's caused what we have now, which is this incredible level of distrust between the communities and the police. And you see it in the response to the Michael Brown case and the response to the Tamir Rice case in Cleveland. You see it here in New York with the Eric Garner case and the Akai Gurley case.
Jonathan, you had Patrick Lynch, who's still on the police force and also the head of the union. So he makes $170-some thousand dollars a year. And you have him saying things that are really incredibly alarming and insubordinate. And instead of Mayor de Blasio telling his police commissioner to fire this guy, instead he's still talking. And de Blasio came out saying that the protest should be suspended. And now you've got Vice President Joe Biden flying in for the funeral. Right. And there seems to be a whole consensus amongst the powers that be that this huge, multiracial, mostly young, nationwide protest that you haven't seen ever, I think, in the history of this country, they seem to be wanting to roll it back and using the event of the murder of these two police officers to do it. What was your reaction to that?
Well, let me divide it up into two different pieces. First of all, the police unions. The police unions have been an absolute impediment to any reform of the police departments in the city of New York over the last several years. We have, in the spring of last year and going into the fall, we reached an agreement with the city, with the police department, to engage in this process of reforming the police department with respect to stop and frisk and their over-aggressive approach to street encounters. All the parties signed off on it. The federal court signed off on it. The one recalcitrant party in that whole mix has been the police unions, and Patrick Lynch has been front and center in that. They are an impediment to change. They do not, the leadership of that union does not reflect the membership anymore. The police department is close to being majority minority. Patrick Lynch is, you know, the vestiges of the old guard who never saw a police officer that did anything wrong. And he's standing in the way. And unfortunately, the tabloids support him. Because he's a union leader, the politicians have to fear him. And, there was really a crying need for a reform movement within that union to get more effective and responsive leadership. So that's with respect to Patrick Lynch. What's going on with respect to the protest and the call to sort of end the protest, I mean, I can understand why they say it, but I don't think it's necessary. The overwhelming majority of these protests have been peaceful, law-abiding. They have not been about calling for the death of police officers. They've been about calling for fair, bias-free, constitutional policing. That's all it's been about. And to use the unfortunate death of these two officers as an attempt to stifle what, as you say, is a growing mass movement that hasn't been seen in this country for, I wouldn't say never been seen, but certainly in many, many years, is unfortunate, and it should be resisted. And I'm happy that people are out there continuing to peacefully protest and to make their voices heard. These are important issues. The killing of Eric Garner, the killing of Akai Gurley, the aggressive policing that takes place in the city of New York and other communities throughout this country is a problem that has to be addressed. And when you have prosecutors and police departments that turn their a blind eye to misconduct, as happened in Ferguson, as happened in Staten Island with the Garner case, then it's important that people make their voices heard on this issue.
Jonathan, it would seem that another impediment to systemic reform is the fact that no national data on the number of people shot by police officers is kept by the FBI or the Department of Justice. Am I wrong that a couple of years ago, police departments were mandated to keep such data but haven't?
Well, I mean, I think there you could find data in terms of the number of people who have been killed. The problem is the data isn't meaningful unless you know the circumstances of it. In New York, for instance, forget about police shootings. The police department doesn't even keep data on the use of force. So the daily use of excessive force that goes on in many communities is never registered, never never gathered by the police department. That's a problem. That's a police department turning a blind eye to a problem that exists and allowing it to happen. The systemic issue with respect to the New York City Police Department is that there's a culture within that police department that has adopted this us-against-them mentality that brooks no criticism for what they do, that there is never a police officer that does wrong. I mean, you had Pat Lynch supporting the officers who assaulted Amadou Diallo and the officers who assaulted Abner Louima. That's how he got his stripes as an early union leader. And until that begins to change, you know, that police officers are going to act with impunity on the street. Nothing happens when an officer violates somebody's constitutional rights. I mean, maybe it goes to court. Maybe there's an exchange of money. Very rarely do you have any systemic change, as we had in the stop and frisk case. But certainly it never has an impact on a police officer's life or his career. I can't tell you how many cases I've been involved in where there's even been a finding of malicious conduct which warrants punitive damages, where the officer has not even been looked at for that. In fact, has been promoted. So it's certainly true with respect to killings, but it's just generally with respect to the use of force that's a problem.
We're talking to Attorney Jonathan Moore, one of the most expert and experienced attorneys in the area of police abuse in the United States. Jonathan, if you had your wishes, how would you reform the New York City Police Department? What would be done to put them on the right path?
Well, that's a very broad question, and I'm not sure I can answer it in the time we have. But I think there has to be a cultural change within the police department. In order to do that, there has to be a recognition of the facts about what has happened over the last so many years. I hearken back to the changes in South Africa, and I think it's a similar thing that's required here. There has to be, first of all, truth before you can have reconciliation. There has to be an understanding and acceptance that what people in the black and Hispanic communities and the poor communities have been saying all these years about over-aggressive policing is, in fact, true. We have to begin to develop systems, early warning systems, the use of body cameras, the use of effective discipline, auditing systems that are out there that simply haven't been used in New York City in any real effective way. For instance, we are embarked in the process in the stop and frisk case where after we've finally have established liability and fought off the police unions who were trying to intervene to take over the appeal that the city didn't want to maintain, didn't want to continue, we've now gotten over that hurdle, and we're now sitting down in what we call a collaborative process to try to come up with reforms in the police department that are based upon hearing the voices of not just plaintiffs or their attorneys or the police officers, but community groups, police reform groups, communities of faith, public defenders' offices, district attorneys' offices, even the unions. They all have a seat at this table that we've constructed as a part of this remedial process in Floyd. Everybody is on board with doing that except the police unions, and so we're going to go forward no matter what. But, that's the place where we start. It is amazing how quickly things can change. In 2011, the police department was doing close to 700,000 stops and frisks every year. And the fear was that if you impeded that ability to do stops and frisks the way they were doing it, we of course know they were doing it based on race, and the federal court found that the police department had been engaging in racial profiling. We knew that, but they denied it. Their alarmist response was if we stop doing stop and frisk, the crime rate will soar. Well, they stopped doing it. They now do on pace to do no more than 50,000 stops and frisks, at least reported stops and frisks this year. That's down 650,000. And that's because they made a change. They stopped imposing quotas on police officers to get numbers in response to crime that occurred in the community. That's a very simple change that took effect and has driven the numbers down. I mean, there are other factors as well that have driven the numbers down, which is now that their police department is being looked at by a federal court in terms of whether they're going to enforce the constitutional guidelines with respect to stop and frisk, so that probably plays a part as well. But my point is that you can make a difference in some of these issues by simply working hard to address the issues, getting all the parties involved. And by the way, we're on a pace to do 50,000 this year, and crime is still going down. So what does that tell you? That tells you for all these years, they were unnecessarily harassing and stopping and frisking young black men and young Hispanic men mostly in our communities for no good reason. And you wonder why there's animosity between the police department and many communities in the city. Look at that as an answer.
Jonathan, we want to ask you about the Garner case because you're now counsel on that. But before we do, I just wanted to add the article that the New York Times printed a few weeks ago about Mr. Seabrook from the corrections officers. Yeah. That was, in my opinion, a stunning expose, especially parts about how he really orchestrated the removal of Florence Finkel from the Civilian Complaint Review Board, because she was actually prosecuting officers.
Well, yeah, I think it was. It was shocking, and he, like Pat Lynch, have really been an impediment to effective change. This city is changing. The police department is changing. It's no longer the police department should no longer be the bastion of mostly Irish men who followed their fathers and their fathers' fathers into the police department. And Pat Lynch represents that old guard, and Norman Seabrook does as well, although he's certainly not, I don't think he's Irish, but these unions blindly defend officers when they engage in misconduct, and that hurts all police officers, that hurts all correction officers, because you don't create the climate where good policing, good correctional practices can flourish. You're simply saying that there's never room for criticism, and that's simply not true. An organization like the NYPD with 35,000 sworn officers, there's going to be people who don't do what they should do. They should be rooted out. They should be removed from the police department. Officer Pantaleo, who killed Eric Garner, who was one of the officers who killed Eric Garner, should not be a police officer, given what he displayed on that video.
Jonathan, can you talk about the Garner case?
Sure, I can talk about it. The Eric Garner case, to me, is a metaphor for really what's going on in the city and what has been going on for the last many, many years. Eric Garner was an individual who existed sort of under the radar of our economic system, somebody who, like many, many people, has to rely on their wits to make a living. He was married for 27 years, had six children, was making a living selling loose cigarettes to people on Bay Street in Staten Island. Everybody knew him there. Everybody respected him. He was a peacekeeper in that community. The police knew him. The police also harassed him a lot. They would give him tickets for selling loose cigarettes, claiming that the store owners around there were upset that he was selling loose cigarettes and taking money away from their businesses. And so what you had happen on July 17th, 2014, when he was killed, was officers coming up, not even having seen him selling loose cigarettes, but investigating the suspicion that he was selling loose cigarettes. So you got to even wonder why they were justified in taking any police action against him. But they came up to him, and he simply said, as these communities are now saying, we've had enough. This has to stop. And you see in the video, he raises his hands and says, I've had enough. And the response from Officer Pantaleo and the other officers in the 120th Precinct, which is a notorious precinct in the city of New York for engaging in racial profiling and misconduct, the response was to attack him and throw him to the ground, a combination of a chokehold and chest compression, and kill him. I mean, he was on the ground and said 11 times to these officers, and you hear it on the videotape, I can't breathe, I can't breathe. And each time he said that, they continued to maintain that compression on his back and on his neck, and that killed him. And that's criminal behavior. I don't care what you say. I don't care what justification you can come up with. He was a large man. Well, no, that doesn't justify what they did to him. That was, in my judgment, murder. And it was even equally more shameful that after they choked him out, they just left him on the ground and didn't provide any emergency assistance to him.
Jonathan, no. I have a question on chokeholds.
Yeah.
You know, that's been litigated for a long time. I know you've been involved in some of that litigation, mm-hmm. Supreme Court cases, et cetera. But chokeholds aren't even authorized to be used by New York City police. Is that right?
Chokeholds were theoretically, they were severely limited. I wouldn't say they were totally banned. They were severely limited as a result of the killing of Anthony Baez by Officer Lavotti, who was prosecuted by the federal government and convicted of assault and put in jail. And there was a police bulletin that went out after that that said you can't use chokeholds unless you need to save your life. Okay, I mean, if somebody's struggling with you and the only way you can survive is by putting your arm around his neck, that would be one, probably the only limited circumstance which you could use it. But essentially, it's been prohibited. The actual regulations read you may not use a hold around the neck that may impair somebody's breathing. What has happened over the years in the police department since the 1994 when Anthony Baez was killed by a chokehold is that the police department has in fact adopted a much more expansive definition of when you can use a chokehold. They now claim that they can use it unless it would substantially impair somebody's breathing. So substantially impair is the next level up is death. So that's why you see the overuse of this technique now. The Civilian Complaint Review Board in a recent report talked about documenting over 1,200 uses of chokeholds over, I think it was a 3 or 4 year period. And this is a technique that is essentially banned, although there are, as I said, some limited circumstances you can use it, and officers are trained not to use. But you see how what happens in the academy doesn't translate to what happens on the street. And that's a problem of supervision, that's a problem of training, that's a problem of discipline within the police department.
Jonathan, I'm interested in what's next and why you think the grand jury didn't come back with an indictment and with the video, with what you said was 11 times I can't breathe, no reason to use the chokehold, no reason to jump on the guy's chest, et cetera. And then what's next? Is there going to be a federal investigation, possibly an indictment? And what are you doing next?
Well, with respect to the grand jury, I mean, everybody understands that the purpose of a grand jury is to indict. It's not to try to prove somebody's guilt or innocence. Following what happened in Ferguson, Missouri, with that district attorney out there, he actually made a statement that the purpose of the grand jury is not to indict, but the purpose is to determine whether somebody is basically guilty of a crime. That turns the use of the grand jury on its head. I mean, in Ferguson and in Staten Island, they turned that grand jury process into a trial with regard to the guilt or innocence of those officers. And what's wrong with that is that it's a trial with only one party litigating it. No opportunity to cross-examine these officers, no opportunity to present any other evidence. And so that's an improper use of the grand jury, and really the grand jury should be abolished. And many states have abolished grand juries. California doesn't use grand juries. You have a charge that's brought, and you have a probable cause hearing, preliminary hearing, and to determine whether there's probable cause. If there's probable cause, you go on to a trial. There's no reason why they couldn't have simply got an indictment in Ferguson or in Staten Island within a few hours. I mean, here's what you had in Staten Island. You had a video that's clear that the use of force was excessive. You have a medical examiner saying the cause of death was a combination of chest and neck compression. You have the officer apparently testifying to the grand jury that he didn't use a chokehold. And when you look at the video, you have to say, he's got to be lying.
Right.
So that those three elements alone should have been sufficient to get an indictment for something. There's a charge in New York called constriction of somebody's breathing. That's a Class A misdemeanor. At least you could get a charge for, that they impaired somebody's ability to breathe.
Yeah, I think people were shocked by it, Jonathan. And so are they actually now going ahead with a federal investigation?
So the end result is that, no indictment. And let me say one other thing, and then I'll talk about the federal thing. What was very telling about this grand jury in Staten Island was that at the beginning, they gave immunity to all the other officers, other than the one officer, Officer Pantaleo, who's shown on the video putting his arm around the neck of Eric Garner. And you have to say to yourself, why would they begin this process by giving all these officers immunity when you had a grand, when you had a medical examiner saying the cause of death was not just the chokehold, it was neck and chest compression? In other words, it wasn't just one officer choking him out, although Pantaleo certainly was doing that. It was officers on his chest preventing him from breathing, pressing him down on the ground. He was a large man. He, you know, obviously was overweight. Any rookie officer knows if you're compressing somebody on the ground like that, they're going to have problems breathing. Why would they give those officers immunity? It's clear that they did not want to get this, these officers indicted. So that gave these officers the ability to come in, and we'll see if we ever get the grand jury minutes, and we will certainly try to do that, come in and say whatever they had to say to get this officer off. And I know what they said in the grand jury without seeing it. They said, this is how we're trained to do it by the New York City Police Department. If that's the case, they should have indicted the New York City Police Department for the death. I mean, they indict coal companies for the death of minors. Why can't they indict the police department? So where we go from here, it's now being investigated by the Eastern District, the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Eastern District of New York. There's certainly a precedent here in New York and elsewhere for the feds coming in and getting an indictment where the state has either failed to get an indictment or failed to get a conviction. Eric Holder called the family of Eric Garner like within minutes of the announcement of the of this grand jury no true bill, saying we are committed to doing a very aggressive, complete investigation of this matter. And I don't think he would have done that had they not really been serious about looking at this. And I expect an indictment. I hope there's an indictment. And I hope it's an indictment of more than just one officer, because they all killed him on that day.
Well, Jonathan, on that note, we want to thank you for all the work you've done over the decades in terms of rectifying police misconduct and really changing policies, and to congratulate you on having this case, and we hope to hear back from you with positive developments.
I'm happy to
thank you,
talk
Jonathan.
With you all anyway.
Great.
All right.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, Sean. Good luck.
Happy holidays.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.